For the week of January 19th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox Fox. Episode 4. What?
Fox. Keep going.
What?
Fox. We bought the rights. We got Fox. We're now Showbiz Sandbox Fox, or if you prefer, Fox Showbiz Sandbox.
Wait, I'm in the middle of the intro here.
I know, but Disney,
I didn't even say the podcast that makes the news, the headlines in the Hollywood, the entertainment business.
The stuff that you say. Disney dumped Fox from 20th Century and Searchlight. They also didn't even upgrade to 21st Century, but that's another story. Disney said, we don't want Fox because we don't want you to think we're connected to
when
Fox
News. When did this happen?
This week. And so now it's just 20th Century and Searchlight. So the Fox was available. I bought it on eBay. So now we have the rights to use the word Fox. So we can just say Showbiz Sandbox Fox.
Oh, okay.
So we've got the rights. It was either that or Megxit. I couldn't decide which one to buy. And I
Megxit
bought that one.
Being the royals leaving the royal family.
That's right. So what episode are we on? Keep going. Sorry. Just don't forget to say Fox because I paid 20 bucks for this.
Well, this is Showbiz Sandbox
Fox.
Fox. Episode 477, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world.
Fox. I mean, we can use it whenever we want.
In Los Angeles, I'm J. Sperling Reich, and Fox.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz, Fox. Sperling, it's great to see you.
You know, if our listeners are still there, well, first of all, thank you. Why are you still here after that intro?
Fox. Well, you know, and you know who's not still here? Watchmen. I thought this was interesting. HBO has said we're not going to do a second season of Watchmen. Damon Lindelof, or everyone says his name, said, you know what? We're done. We've told our story. We did what we wanted to do. I know people who loved it. Our in-house film and TV critic, Aaron Rich, says it was great. He really liked Watchmen, thought it ended very well. After he saw it, he said, I don't know how they could do a season two. I don't think it needs one. And that's what the creative people said. And now HBO has said, we're happy. They're happy. Let's move on and make something else. Sometimes a show only needs to be one season or six episodes or nine episodes or two seasons. And it's great to see more American television and streamers following the lead of the UK, which said, you know, let the creatives decide.
So, I mean, but did you watch Watchmen? That's a lot of watches in one sentence.
Who's watching The Watchmen? That's the question that they asked in the graphic novel. That's what they're asking on the show. No, I have not watched it yet. I'm looking forward to it very much. Right now, I am listening furiously to albums. I'm listening, catching up, listening to some albums one more time, listening to some stuff that slipped through the cracks because I want to get my best of the year list done before we hit the Grammys next Sunday.
What's an album?
An album is a cool thing that still exists and still matters.
Okay,
Bad Bunny knows that albums still matter. He did a stream of singles. He collaborated with J Balvin, but he put out an album Christmas Eve in 2018, and it's one of the best albums of the year, and I can't wait to talk about that stuff next week. But what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, apparently we're going to talk about how Disney decided to drop the name Fox from everything. Why they would drop the name Fox and keep the 20th is beyond me, but I don't know. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we are still celebrating our SAG Award for Best Duo in a nonprofit podcast your parents have never heard of. So thank you to the voters of the Screen Actors Guild and all of our fans. Now, after our award, SAG apparently handed out other statues, and we'll cover those along with the big winner from the Producers Guild of America. Oh, by the way, the Oscars is anyone's race, but the awards leading up to it sure are making the Academy Awards this year look like a fait accompli. That's a fancy French word, by the way.
At least for the acting slots. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Although everybody thought that last year with Glenn Close, and you know what she says? Yeah, still don't have one. Still don't have an Oscar. But also in movie news, we've got some more worldwide box office figures for 2019, a deeper analysis of the Oscar nominations, and the first of many press releases about how much money the heads of entertainment companies are raking in. What's another word for lots? And by the way, I did look that up. Another word for lots is a group. Okay, that's one. Yeah, a clique. That's
keep another. Going.
Okay, well, movies aren't the only awards being handed out. The Grammys happen next Sunday, and Michael will save you the bother of watching the show. He already knows who's going to get Album of the Year. Yep. Well, that's good. I was wondering who would get that. On Inside Baseball, the Grammys are making all the wrong sort of headlines this week because the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences kicked out its new head just days before the big night. Does that mean I need to get my resume?
Yes.
In order? Okay. Well, the rumors are ugly right now on both sides, and they're only going to get uglier. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to you, Michael, entertainment journalist extraordinaire. You're going to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. Then we pull info from a Bollywood website, from a Chinese box office website, from Box Office Profit and Deadline and The Times and The LA Times and Variety and Hollywood Reporter. Everybody, you, our readers, send us in info. That's why we have like 30 plus movies on our list right now. We're covering a lot of stuff you won't hear about anywhere else. The trades are getting better about covering international film. They're getting better about covering a little bit news on this and that movie when it becomes a big hit. But we're telling you about all of them all the time whenever we can. So we'll try to keep this brief or at least succinct. And here we go. The number one movie around the world is Bad Boys for Life. It made $97 million on its opening week. And apparently the budget for this sequel starring Will Smith and Martin Lawrence is $90 million. Really? Really? Do you buy that?
90 million? No. Yes, I do.
If, well, if you're not including the salaries of the two guys.
Well, I do think that, you know, certainly Will Smith, he probably makes a pretty penny. Martin Lawrence does not.
Oh, he does for this movie. And he is a big TV draw. And it's the third in a series. And it's a big budget action flick. There is no way this movie costs 90 million. I don't buy it. I don't buy it. But it made $97 million this week. It got friendly reviews, good buzz, great audience word of mouth. So this puppy's going to be just fine, whatever it costs.
Well, but here's the thing. Here's what I would say is it's not a big, you know, science fiction, action adventure, superhero movie. So beyond, let's say both of them got $20 million. That's $40 million. You have $50 million to make the rest of your movie. You can do that.
That's big action budget stuff. Plus, Will Smith gets $20 million plus. $20 million in gross, right? He gets a piece.
You know, that's the problem these days. Getting a piece of the gross is very difficult.
Not if you're Will Smith.
Oh, you'd be shocked.
Well, let's send us his contract.
Yes, if you know, please, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We'll keep it all anonymous right after we name you.
That's right. At number two around the world is 1917, the World War I flick that is poised for good success at the Oscars. It made another $78 million around the world. It's at $140 million and counting. In the old days, we always talked about box office. These days, movies are released all year round. They can benefit when they're on streaming platforms or on DVD and Blu-ray or just becoming a valuable piece of the library. Poising that movie so it can capitalize at the box office doesn't seem to be the priority. And I think that's the way it should be. It's a rare movie that you can say, all right, we want to plan it so it comes out wider, right? As the, you know, you just can't know what's going to happen at the Oscars. So building your whole campaign around that to me is a little foolish. This movie sort of did that and it paid off a lot.
Well, it came out right after it was nominated for 10 Academy Awards.
Right. So, well, they could have all have done that, but then a lot of people would find themselves disappointed.
Correct.
At number three around the world is a movie that is a bit of a disappointment. It's Doolittle, the new franchise starring Robert Downey Jr. It cost $175 million to make. It opened up last week in a few small territories. This week, it opened up wider, including North America. It made $41 million over the last week. It's at $50 million and counting. Now, it cost about $175 million to make. That one, I believe. And yeah, it's got a ways to go. Maybe audiences will hate it just as much as critics did. It certainly didn't have great word of mouth, but you don't want to write it off right away. It certainly doesn't look good for this movie that it's going to get to, you know, $600, $550 million. But hold your breath, but it's certainly a poor start.
No, and last week I kind of mentioned, well, you know, why did they release it in January, even though, look, you can release good movies 12 months a year. And by the way, I suggest you do that.
Yep.
But, you know, January gets a bad rap when you start releasing movies like Doolittle in January.
Well, you make a film and then at some point you have to release it. They didn't plan to make a bad movie, but there you go. And number four is Jumanji, The Next Level. $37 million it made this week. That has passed the $700 million mark. It looks like it won't quite catch up to what the last one did, but it's still a lot of money and profitable for everyone involved. However, interest is waning, perhaps. Perhaps you've pushed it to the limit. Perhaps there's not a Jumanji 3 to make right now. So maybe you shouldn't rush into Jumanji 3 unless you get a really good script. At number five is Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. $37 million this week, just like Jumanji. It passed the $1 billion mark as we knew it would. $1,026,000,000. It's going to end up at about $1.1 billion, maybe $1.2 but it's slowing down for sure. But it's not as much as the last one or the first one, but it's still a big, big success.
Now, I saw this movie, as you know, Michael.
So
did I. Can't remember a darn thing about it. Frankly, it's just not a good movie.
I do remember the Ewoks were there, and that seemed like a bad idea.
Yeah, good point.
At number six is Frozen 2. That made another $30 million. Again, this is the family-friendly choice for the holiday season, and it is paying off big time for a movie that opened up, what, at Thanksgiving?
It's yes.
At $1.4 billion.
And yet, I believe it's up for best anime. No, it's not, actually.
Well, that's okay. They made a lot of money. At number seven is Ip Man 4, the finale. Another $25 million for that flick, and they're about to hit $200 million. I am not sure about those numbers. The total amount that we have this week is $25 million more than the total amount we had last week, but it's very confusing about where or how it made that money. Again, sometimes with movies playing around the world, numbers come in slowly. And so some week they may have found an extra $8 million somewhere or $6 million. This is not that uncommon. And it wasn't added to the total properly and say, oh, all right, we gotta put that in there. So the jump will come this week officially, but it doesn't mean the money was made that week. It's possible Ip Man 4 made as little as $3 million this week, but we're just reflecting the difference between our big total last week and the total worldwide box office we have this week. It ain't easy keeping track of the worldwide box office. It's a hard job for ComScore, and it's even harder for us when we try to include every movie we can, like Little Women. That made $21 million this week. That's at $130 million worldwide. Then at number nine is a big film from India, Tanhaji. I'm sorry about my pronunciation. I forgot to look it up. Tanhaji, the Unsung Warrior, about a female warrior, a legend in her time. $20 million she made this week all over the world. She's at $25 million total. At number 10 is Spies in Disguise. The, was it Scott Blue Sky? What's the name of the anime?
Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, yeah. That's one of the films that Disney picked up when they gobbled up Fox and then spat out the name Fox. But Spies in Disguise made another $17 million. It's at $130 million and counting. Remember,
wouldn't it be funny if they like put the name Fox there, like Blue Fox?
Yeah, you know, it's we think this movie cost about $100 million, given the budgets for the last three or four movies from Blue Sky and the big names involved, including
Will Smith.
That's right. So this one not doing great so far. It has a ways to go, I guess. How many territories is it playing in? Blue Sky is playing in about, Spies in Disguise. It's in 40 territories. I'm not sure how many it has opened up yet or how many are left. So we can't write it off completely, but it's a long ways to go before it gets to $300 million. Right below that is Sheep Without a Shepherd, the Chinese crime drama. That made another $16 million. That's at $165 million. That's a big, big hit.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. And it's a remake.
And they changed the ending dramatically.
Yes, it's unbelievable that movie is doing so well.
And finally, we've solved a mystery. We had a movie called Servant, but we couldn't figure out where it was from or what it was called or who made it. Now we know its official name is probably Kholop, Kholop. It's a Russian comedy, sort of a spin on The Truman Show. It's about a dad who's wealthy financier or something, and he has a spoiled son, a young man, really, not a kid, but he's spoiled, rotten, and hateful, and horrible, and the dad decides he has to do something drastic. So he fakes a car accident for the son, and then the son believes he has traveled back in time because of this car accident to, like, 14th century Russia or something, and now he's a peasant or a kholop. But in this case, it's really a serf, or even less than a serf. You're barely better than an enslaved person. So you are the lowest of the lows. And he's in this village that the dad found, which was abandoned. They people it with actors. So they're all pretending to be in the 14th century. He believes he's now a serf, traveled back in time. There are cameras everywhere watching his every move. There are scientists and psychiatrists observing the son and seeing what will happen through this game that they're playing, making him think he's gone back in time and is now at the bottom of the rung rather than the top of the rung. So it's The Truman Show, it's inequality, and maybe it's a commentary on the wealthier than wealthy people, the oligarchs of Russia. But it's been made, and this week it made $13 million. It's at $43 million and counting. We don't know the budget, but that sounds like a lot of money for a comedy in Russia.
I'm sorry, my silence is only because I'm on the other line here pitching remakes, and this just jumped to the top of the list.
At number 13 is Knives Out, which won't be remade, but it will get a sequel. It made another $12 million this week. It's at $280 million. It's going to hit $300 million worldwide. For a movie with a reported budget of $40 million, you can bet all the big stars that get in that next movie, it'll be a whole new cast except for Daniel Craig, all the big names that get involved, they're going to want a little bit more than last time. At 14 is Underwater, the sci-fi action flick that made another $12 million. Below that is another big Chinese hit. It's that drama Adoring about people who love their pets. They also love this movie. $11 million this week. It's at $92 million. Below that is Just Mercy, a one-time Oscar hopeful starring Jamie Foxx and Michael B. Jordan. Heh, now it just wants to make money at the box office, and it's doing it. It made $10 million this week. It's at $20 million and counting. The Brazilian flick My Mom is a Character 3 made $8 million last week. So did Sarileru Neyu Kuvaru. Oh, God forgive me for that one. That's another Indian film that made $8 million this week. It's at $15 million and counting. And then right below that are three films that made $7 million this week. The horror flick The Grudge, Jojo Rabbit, another film that's doing great with Oscar buzz. Platform now opening up in January, really capitalizing on its Oscar glory. That's at $43 million worldwide. And below that is Like a Boss, the modest comedy starring Tiffany Haddish that made another $7 million this week. And then Bombshell, that made $5 million this week. It has proved a bomb when it comes to Oscar hopes. It's not winning big at any of the other ceremonies or award shows. It's at $34 million and counting. It needs to make like $90 million to be considered a hit just at the box office alone. Given the big names involved, you know, that's one of those movies that's an insurance, you know, a little bit of insurance. When you've got such big names involved in the cast, you know that's going to help you down the road, even if you haven't delivered right off the bat.
This seems to me like one of those movies that years from now people will run across and be like, how did I miss this?
Or they think it's better than it is, yeah?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Maybe they'll say it about this Italian comedy, Me Against You, or Me Contro Te, La Vendetta del Signor S. I made that sound Spanish rather than Italian, but it's Me Against You, The Revenge of Signor S. It sounds like it's a sequel, but I think it might be spun off from a TV series. I'm not quite clear, but it made about $5 million this week. As did another broad comedy, Secret Zoo. This is a Korean comedy made for furries. I don't know how else to say it, but it's about young, beautiful people who run a zoo, and I guess they've run out of animals or something. So in a panic, they decide to put on animal costumes and go out and pretend to be a real animal. So all the animals are played by human beings in furry costumes, and people believe it. Oh, look, that polar bear just opened up a Coke. Oh, look, that lion is staring at me. It sounds ridiculous, and it is, but it made $5 million on its opening weekend. Some people who have a kink are really going to love that movie.
Oh, my God. And
below that is Ford versus Ferrari. That made $4 million, as did the Guy Ritchie crime drama The Gentleman, as did a big Oscar hopeful, Parasite. That one big last night. We'll be talking about that soon. It made another $4 million. It's at $150 million worldwide, a huge success story for one of the biggest Korean films and one of the best international language films of all time. And then there's a bunch of movies that made $3 million. Richard Jewell, Chepak, the Indian acid attack drama, Good News, another Indian film. And then there's two movies that we had missed in the last few weeks. Spy Seas, which is a Chinese animated film that made $3 million this week. And then a Japanese animated film opening up in China called Violet Evergarden, Eternity and the blah, blah, blah. I forget what it's called. That made $3 million. That's at about $10 million. Worldwide, along with another Chinese film, Warriors of Hornor. As you can see, we've got six or eight films that are making big money or all of their money right now in China alone. So yes, United States films did not do as well this year as it has before, but there's a lot of movies being made and then released in China, both by them and other countries. So they are showing Indian films, they are showing Japanese films and Hollywood films, and that's good for everybody. Oh, and they're showing Life is Beautiful, the Italian movie, you know, from 1997. So the Chinese market is an interesting one.
I think it's 1999, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Life is Beautiful. But now The Farewell also opened in China. Now, you would think that movie, it stars Awkwafina. In a movie that is mostly in Chinese, but is effectively an American-produced film. It was at Sundance last year. And in China, it's called Don't Tell Her. It's a great film. It opened up to $350,000 besides, you know, it was shot in China. Okay, it stars mostly Chinese people. You would think it would do gangbusters there.
Well, one reason it may not have is piracy. A lot, you know, there are like, there are 30,000 reviews or 20,000 plus reviews of the movie, even though only barely that many people saw it. So clearly a lot of people had seen it elsewhere or in other ways. The reviews were polite, but not great in general, as far as the trades are concerned or the critics. And there were some nasty comments about Awkwafina. Some people complaining, why does Hollywood only embrace a movie where the star isn't really that attractive? You know, like, well, screw you, because she's not as attractive as Gong Li. Like, that's the only person who gets to make movies in China. But there are nasty comments about stars no matter where you go in the world. It's not just happening in the U.S. So that was interesting to see. But she's a great talent. I didn't love the movie like you. It was okay. But it's interesting that it did not do well. It didn't do well as Crazy Rich Asians, which we were told, oh, no, the Chinese won't be in touch with that movie because it's too much about wealthy people. Well, they were okay with that. And this week is going to be big for China. That's why we're talking about China so much. It's the Chinese Lunar New Year. That's that time of year when a ton of people travel from all over China to get home. They want to be with their families on Chinese Lunar New Year, kind of like Thanksgiving for us. That takes place on January 24th, and there will be 12 big Chinese films opening up over the holiday season. No big Hollywood movies. It's all Chinese movies, including The Rescue, directed by Dante Lam. He's had big action films. That one is opening up in North America one day before it opens up in China. It's one of their biggest budget movies of all time. I've seen the trailer, and people need a lot of rescuing. They need rescuing on land and sea and air. Oh my God, do they need rescuing? So we'll have to see what it's like, but that's fascinating. You know, the global box office is worth paying attention to.
Yes, in fact, North American ticket sales last year, and I you just said global, and I'm kind of just bringing it back to North America for a moment, because initial primary numbers are in, and it seems that ticket sales went down 4% to 1.24 billion tickets sold last year, the second lowest in this century. The century is only 20 years old, however.
One-fifth dumb, but still, that's not good. Attendance really matters. The average ticket price sort of rose to $9.16. Why do
That's how you have ticket prices, you know, that's how you have the total revenue kind of flatlining rather than plummeting.
Well, right. Ticket prices are keeping pace with inflation, as in general is attendance. So this year is down. It's down significantly, of course, the lowest in the century, second lowest in the century. Not great. But again, it's not, you know, once you see 5 years of that, then you're talking about a trend. One off year in terms of ticket sales is not that big a tell. Never good, but you can't expect to go up every year. You don't want to fall that much. But I really get annoyed that we don't know actual ticket sales and we don't know actual ticket prices. You know, there should be a better, all they do is take the total box office and divide it by the total number of ticket sales. And then they tell us, well, the average ticket price is this. It'd be better to know how many kids tickets did you sell? How many, how many discounted, you know, get a chart showing us actual ticket sales. But no, all the theater chains hold on to that data. They don't want to share it. But we do know some details. There were increases in attendance for every age group under 34. So when you're looking at young people, little kids,
that's actually a
teenagers,
good thing.
Of course it's a good thing. It's always good to have attendance rise in any age group, but to have all the young people going to the movies and doing more so this year than last year, that's a great sign because that means they're getting the habit of going to the movies.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, you know, Michael, I've been banging this drum for a while. It's when you start losing the younger generations that you see an art form start to perish.
And we have perished. And we haven't lost younger generations in 50 years, and we're not doing so now. But we are getting lots of awards. There are more awards than ever, even if there aren't more young people.
You should see my shelf. It's like impossible. Look, Academy, I appreciate anything you're willing to hand out to us, to Michael and I. There's no more room on the shelf.
You can take yourself out of the nomination. You can politely decline the nomination. It's like, you know, Bill Cosby at the Emmys. You could do that.
Yes, I'm going to do that like the way Tom Hanks does it. He doesn't do that.
No, he doesn't do that. So we've had three big awards over the weekend. The editors gave out their big award, the ACE Awards. They don't give out one top prize, and I strongly suggest they do so. You can give out an award for drama. This year it went to Parasite. You can give out an award to comedy. This year it went to Jojo Rabbit. But people, lay your money down. Name your top film of the year. Everybody should do that. Same with the costume people and the production design. pick a top winner because you want to have an influence. You need to be in the game. That's the case for the Producers Guild of America. They named their top pick, and it is 1917, another big win for that movie. And that was followed immediately by the SAG Awards. Their big win, for the first time in history, they picked a film from another country in another language. It's Parasite.
Which is why you saw at the Academy Awards all of those actors nominated for Best Actress and Best
Right. There's support. No acting nomination for anyone in Parasite, except the Actors Guild gave their top prize to the movie. Figure that one out. That doesn't make any sense. However, before you think, well, the SAG, the actors are the biggest branch in the Academy, and therefore if SAG loved a movie, that means it's got a great chance of winning the Best Picture. Well, sure it does. It certainly helps to win the SAG Award. However, in the last 4 years, the SAG winner has not won the Oscar for Best Picture.
So who was the SAG winner last year? Was it Roma?
Black Panther.
Black Panther. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. That's right, actually. I always forget this. And who was it the year before that?
I have not memorized all of them.
Oh, okay. The
last one that actually won was Birdman.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yes.
Yeah, because that was better than Boyhood, definitely.
Yes. So, the ensemble in a motion picture, they've only been doing it for 20 years, so they don't have a big track record. But the last 4 years, it's been before this, Black Panther, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Hidden Figures. Oh, I'm sorry. It was Spotlight. Spotlight won Best Picture. So it's the last 3 years. I beg your pardon.
Yeah, so between the Screen Actors Guild and the Ace Eddie Awards and the Cinematography Awards, I think cinematography actually does hand out a best of. But what they're trying to do, of course, is honor the people that work in the field.
In their craft, also, yeah.
Yeah, and the reality is, action-adventure editors often only get action-adventure work. And likewise for drama, likewise for comedy. So they split them up and say, look, editing a drama and editing a comedy are different skill sets. They're the same in terms of, yes, you're working with the same tools.
Yeah, I don't mind these categories. You do a period drama. That's different than creating costumes for a fantasy spectacle. Nonetheless, right. You should pick a top prize.
Meanwhile, over at SAG, they have an ensemble award. And that's really that ensemble award is
their equivalent to Best Picture.
Yeah, I wonder if they consider it that.
They absolutely do. Of course they do. They're just that's why a movie with one person in it, however, would be, handicapped come the SAG Awards. If you have one or two people dominating a film like The Two Popes, you're probably far less likely to win than a show with a big cast. That's got to help. So,
but I wonder how many times the film that has won the Ensemble Award has also won an individual acting SAG Award.
Well, many times. Why? You think they love the film but then don't honor the actors? Well,
they try and spread the love.
Well,
people
don't always vote that way. It just depends. Some people have, you try to read the tea leaves and you just drive yourself nuts. Well, if he doesn't get an editing war, he won't win that. It's like none of it is a rule. It's just after the fact, people try to figure out what was going on. Oh, this year they spread the love. Next year they'll say, oh, they really love this movie because it all went to this. There's no rule. There's no hard and fast rule.
Well, okay, but we did mention that that the acting nominees, the nominations are pretty much now a lock, right?
It sure looks like it. I imagine there's always a curveball, and if it will happen, I think it's in Best Supporting Actress. Best Actor looks like Joaquin Phoenix. Best Actress looks like Renee Zellweger for Judy. Best Supporting Actor is certainly Brad Pitt for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And Best Supporting Actress, the front runner, is certainly Laura Dern for Marriage Story, who also got a lot of attention for her work in Little Women. But one of those categories is going to be in flux. Supporting Actress has often been a wild card. I wouldn't be surprised if another actress from Little Women won in Best Supporting Actress, Florence Pugh. She's gotten a lot of attention, but anybody could win. But right now, if you're putting your money down, you want to be the smart, safe bet, don't outthink yourself. Just pick those four for the acting nominations.
Do you don't think that female actor.
Anything could happen. They win everything, it's more likely they're probably going to win that one too.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, but we do know that a lot of films are really embraced this year. Four films received 10 plus nominations at the Academy Awards. That's never happened before in history. Those are The Irishman, Joker, 1917, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Now, neither 1917 or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood got an editing nomination, and that's usually a telltale sign. You want to get like screenplay and director and editing. If you're missing one of those, that makes you look a little weak. There's a reason 1917 might not have got editing, because it's made to look like it isn't edited, even though we know it is. So maybe it's more of a sign of weakness for Once Upon a Time. But along with those four films, we also have Parasite, one of the most nominated international films of all times. They did get an editing and directing and screenplay nomination. So that's a really big nominee. Parasite looks really strong come Oscar time. But if you go back in history, you have to go back to the 70s to find a time when three films were nominated for 10 or more awards. In fact, it's only happened two times in history, in the 70s and then in the 60s. In the 70s, it was Julia, The Turning Point, and Star Wars. They loved those movies. They all got 10 plus nominations. None of them won Best Picture. The winner was Annie Hall, which only had 5 nominations. So Parasite is looking at that and going, aha! Then you go back to the 60s. Three films had 10 plus nominations. Mary Poppins, Beckett, and My Fair Lady. Never before in history have four films received 10 plus nominations, though we came close in 1941. Back in the 14th Annual Academy Awards, Sergeant York got 11, How Green Was My Valley got 10, and two films got 9 nominations, Citizen Kane and The Little Foxes. Citizen Kane really should have had more than one acting nomination, and if it had, that would have put it over the top. So you look back over the history of the Oscars, this has never happened before. Pete Hammond did the math on all this at Deadline, but I had done it first. I did it as well. I was doing it for my friends at the IRAs, this annual awards group. Someone said, wow, those four movies sure got a lot of nominations. Didn't they see anything else? And I went, oh, that's a good point. And I looked it up just like Pete Hammond did. That's an amazing history. Only twice in history have we even come close to what happened this year at the Oscars. Another big thing is that these movies are profitable and they're popular.
Right. I mean, that was the whole point behind expanding to 10 nominees, because once The Dark Knight didn't get a Best Picture nomination, everybody said, oh, come on, there's nobody's going to watch these awards if we're basically picking a bunch of art films that 5 people saw.
And Joker is a billion-dollar franchise. Yeah, but of course, you want to pick the best movies. But Joker is a billion-dollar movie. A lot of people saw it, and it's up for the Oscar. 1917, it looks like a popular hit. That's doing gangbusters at the box office. The Irishman, that one, we don't know how popular it was. We don't know how much people are watching it on Netflix. But we know Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is another good, strong success story for Quentin Tarantino. I think it's his second highest grossing movie of all time. And Parasite's one of the biggest art films of all time.
Well, and, you know, a couple things. One, The Irishman, we do know how many people are pausing it on Netflix.
And that is
everyone who starts it. You know, we were talking for just a half a second prior to starting this week's episode about the Cannes Film Festival and how so many of these films, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Parasite and others, got their start at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah, anyone who thinks Cannes doesn't matter, good Lord. 21 films that debuted there are represented in the Academy Awards. They have 2 Best Picture nominees, 3 International Pick nominees, an animated film. The last Cannes film to win Best Picture was Marty in 1955.
Wow, I did not know that. I will say this.
You know, Palme d'Or winner, like Parasite.
Right. So, you know, they showed this past year, 2019, they showed Once Upon a Time in Hollywood at 6 p.m., okay? And then at 10 p.m., they showed Parasite back-to-back on the same day. You want to talk about a great day of film going. But I will never forget being in that audience for Parasite. It was electric. Mm-hmm. You could really feel like when that film ended. Now, I thought it was because Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was a Quentin Tarantino film, and everybody had high expectations for it, and it was not necessarily the Pulp Fiction they all hoped it would be. And then they go see Parasite, which was completely unexpected and really great.
Mm-hmm. So that's great for Cannes, and it's great for the Oscars that they have these movies that people are seeing. Ford versus Ferrari is not a big hit at the box office, but it's big stars, and it's certainly a familiar movie, so that's a successful film. Jojo Rabbit, that's a big art house hit. Little Women, that's a popular hit. Still making money all over the world. So these are movies people have seen or want to see or have heard good things about. This is a great year for the Oscars to maybe bump up a little bit in the ratings.
You know, I was walking around my neighborhood and outside the movie theater, in my neighborhood, which is a Regal movie theater. It has six screens. There are posters, many posters, in fact, for Little Women, and they're character posters. So they're just one character from the film. Very, very nice, very good presentation, very, very nice marketing. The movie theater there is not showing Little Women. So I took a picture of like the poster that's advertising it outside. You know, it's basically like a billboard that the movie theater has nothing to do with, and the movie theater not showing Little Women. Instead, they're that's like, you know, a billboard outside a grocery store saying, "Hey, buy these
food.
Apples.
Not here.
Yeah, not here. Go across. You know, go to our competitor." It's just so silly.
Well, you know, Greta Gerwig was snubbed by the Oscars. Unless you look at the Best Director nominees and realize the four films that got 10 plus nominations are all on the Best Director list, as did one of the most honored foreign films of all time. So the five Best Director nominees are for the five most popular films by most measurements. So it only makes sense that they would match up. It does raise the question. I am all for just saying 10 films of the year. Why bother with 9, 8, 7, 10? Why rotate it? Just say 10. There are 10 good movies a year. If there aren't, that's the movie's fault, not the list's fault. And, you know, you could have 10 Best Director nominees, someone said. Yeah, but then you have 10 Best Actors, 10 Best... Lord, it gets exhausting. At some point, you're going to narrow it down to one. And maybe the place to start after Best Picture is Best Director or Best Actor. But then, you know, the wheels hit the road and you realize, okay, these are the favorites. But it's something to think about. I do think they should just say 10 nominees. Why not? There'd be one more movie on the list. Who would care, right? Would it be awful? Yeah.
No.
I hate this 8, 9, 7, 10. Just... Everybody understands best.
You know my feeling about the whole preferential ballot.
Well, it's got nothing to do with preferential ballot. That's a separate issue. That has nothing to do with how many slots you have. You can have 10 films with preferential balloting or with straightforward first up past the gate balloting.
No, but preferential balloting is how they have.
Well, it's not necessary. It's not the one did not lead to the other. You can have 10 films with preferential balloting or you can have 10 films with regular balloting. It has nothing to do with it. It's a separate issue.
Well, no, what I'm referring to, and I'm only speaking about the nominating process here.
But nominating process is not why they have those rotating numbers of slots. That was a decision. You could have 10 slots with that process.
Yes, however, the way they do it is
I understand, but it's not linked to it. The decision of how many films to nominate, 5, 10, or a rotating number, is separate from how you do the nominating process. It's a separate issue. It's not, oh, we're doing preferential, therefore we must have 7, 8, or 9. Those are separate issues.
Well, that's how they get to the 7, 8, or 9.
Yes, but they could get to 10 that way or 5 that way. They could say we're only going to have 5 and still use preferential balloting. They could say we're absolutely going to have 10 and use preferential balloting. That is a separate issue from the number of films they decide to include on the final list.
So what you're saying is they can still use a preferential nomination process.
To do whatever they want for 5 or 10 or 6 or 9. It doesn't matter.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's a great list. Well, it's a great list. It's a popular list. We'll have to see if that affects the ratings. The Academy is more diverse. They have 9,000 members. Only 16% are people of color. However, that's twice as many as there were in 2015. So it's a long, slow haul to get those numbers up. And, you know, doubling it in 4 years, that's a good sign. You know, that's good progress. It's not as much progress as you want. They could go faster, but they are grabbing people everywhere. They are doing a much better job. They just have to keep their nose to the grindstone.
Well, you know what is in progress, according to Bob Iger, is his salary, because it went down by 18.
What a terrible job he did this year.
18. Yeah, what he bought a whole other studio. You know, he said, look, okay, it's a lot of money. We'll have to, you know, it takes some out of my pay.
They'll say, fine, we'll take $18 million. He said, wait, what? 18,
yeah.
Well, last year, he had a big stock package that he got, something that vested or whatever. So it was a one-time huge increase. So he's back down to his typical $45, $50 million a year. That's Bob Iger. He's the first one out of the gate when it comes to CEO pay. We'll be hearing about a lot more people getting ridiculous sums of money down the road. Everybody at Disney, go ask for a raise. Everybody go to HR right now and say, he got $50 million? I'd like a raise. And then they will say, actually, he got a cut.
Well, speaking of getting a cut, agents get a cut of what their clients make. If they have clients. And right now, none of the big agencies have writer clients, technically. Although at this point, I don't see how
they're breaking the rules? And
I think they have to be. I mean, I'd be shocked if writers are not communicating with their agents. But that said, I mean, for instance, it'll be very interesting to see when the nominate when the winners take the stage at the Writers Guild Awards and the Academy Awards.
They've worked with them for years. Just because they thank them doesn't mean.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, yeah. Anyway, the big news in the WGA battle with the top agencies is that Gersh has signed the WGA agreement. And this isn't some small boutique or an agency that just handles literary stuff, is it?
No. It's actually a pretty well-known agency. They've been around for decades.
Oh, yeah.
They represent big-name talent. Adam Driver, for instance, I believe is represented there.
And more importantly?
They do some packaging. Not a lot, but they do some packaging.
That's right. They've got Drew Carey on The Price is Right. That's got to be a package deal. That's got to be worth a pretty penny. So, you know, they didn't package the show, but they may have gotten a cut of that. I don't know how all that works. But Gersh signing this deal, that's a significant blow to the agencies, isn't it?
I want to know what's in the deal, though. In other words, well, they signed it, but was it the deal that Gersh wanted to sign or the deal that the WGA wanted?
They did sign it. So the point is that they signed it. And like everybody else, there are things that can still be negotiated down the road. They have maybe made a tweak to it that we have not heard of something. But as everybody else has signed on, they said, okay, we like this. This doesn't seem workable. What about that? And they have negotiated in good faith, as they said they would all along. They didn't say their initial suggestion was written in stone. They're ready to negotiate, but they have some core values like, hey, you should represent us and not yourself. That's their core value that they want people to sign on to. And then everything else is up for negotiation. We don't want you to do packaging. We don't even want to do this or that. You can keep doing packaging until we get two of the big three or whatever the rule is. So I'm sure they have some tweaks and whatever, but they have signed on. They have agreed. They want to keep working with their writers. And now they're back on board. And, you know, maybe it's just in time for a strike.
Yeah, because now there's some talk about, since so few of these agencies have signed on, that there will be a writer strike.
Well, not because strictly this. They also have issues with producers, studio. They have issues with everybody. It's not just they're going to strike because they haven't signed a deal with agents. It's they're going to strike because they can't come to a good deal with the Producers Guild or whoever the representing people are.
Yeah, correct. Right.
So the LA Times has a good story about the potential strike, about what people are doing to prepare, the likelihood of it. And they repeat again what the Writers Guild is saying. Look, more writers than ever are getting more work. We're in more demand than ever before in history. We are being overwhelmed with work. You know, there's 500 plus scripted shows in North America alone. Tons of movies are being made. So why, when we should be in more demand than ever and we should be able to get better prices, are more and more of our writers getting the minimum or just above the minimum? Not only that, we're having shorter seasons because streamers are not ordering, you know, 20, 30 episodes like major networks did. And more, we're not getting a back end. There's not even the possibility of syndication or some back end profits down the road. So we're getting less money up front and no money in the back end. So this doesn't make any sense to us. It doesn't seem right. And we may have to strike.
You know,
will
what's
you hear the people sing? Sorry.
One of these stories we link to in our show notes, apparently assistants at CAA are getting a pay raise. When I worked there, it was $10 an hour. It was $10 an hour for like 20 some odd years.
Yeah, but that was when you were there in the 20s, weren't you?
In the 20s?
Yes, before the Great Depression.
No.
Oh, no. Well, yes, no. They've bumped them up to like $18 or $19 an hour. And I'm like,
eh. 18.
Oh,
18,
I'm like, yeah. Well, okay. You're not exactly showering them with money because the national minimum wage should be 15, for God's sake. But yeah, any raise is helpful. But this feels more like, all right. Okay, fine. What about this? You know, rather than a substantial, you know, and they're like, yeah, we help them defray their student loan costs. And it's like, oh, yeah, whatever.
Well, yeah. But that said, they do make overtime. And I have to say, I made probably a 30% increase once overtime was
well, that's because they work you like dogs and you're there 90 hours a week. They
yes,
should be paying
and
you
by
more.
Dogs, you mean chihuahuas. I mean
huskies working in the Alaskan tundra. Well, I know the Grammy Awards have been working overtime as well. And who is going to win Album of the Year? We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 nominees. God forbid it be 10. God forbid we say what are the 10 best albums of the year like everybody else. But the nominees are an interesting mix. Bon Iver, Lana Del Rey, Billie Eilish, Ariana Grande, Her, Lil Nas X, Lizzo, and Vampire Weekend. You can argue back and forth about whether these are the best albums of the year, and there's no way they're your best albums of the year. But you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 women, three male acts, you know, one solo, two groups. Mostly Bon Iver is helmed by one guy, but it's an interesting mix. I've got one, two, three of those albums are on my best of the year list. Lizzo's okay, right so towards the top.
You know, I'm gonna kind of preempt you here mm-hmm. and say, who wins?
Lizzo.
I thought the same thing. I looked at that list and I thought, I don't know if Lana Del Rey can. I mean, there's a lot of love for that album. I don't know if she can pull that off. Billie Eilish will win Best New Artist. Bon Iver, people like are like, who? Vampire Weekend. I don't know if it. I don't
that
know.
Could be
I,
the old. That could be the old person's vote. You know,
yeah, even though they're I mean, not I really that like old, that album.
I like it too. That's one of my three albums that are on the Best of the Year list. Lizzo, Vampire Weekend, and Billie Eilish are all on my Best of the Year list. Not Bon Iver or Lana Del Rey or the others, but Vampire Weekend is a great band. It's the third, fourth album. They've been working hard. It could be the one that traditionalists can sort of go, okay. But Lizzo, that'd be a great win. A person of color, a bold, funny woman. She's strong. She's had great years. She's been in social media. She's been on Saturday Night Live. She's making news all the time. She's got a great voice. It's got classic old soul and hip hop and rap. It would be a really bold, great choice. She does have the most nominations, 8 nominations for that album. So that's obviously a good sign of a lot of broad support for her. So I would not be surprised at all. I think Lizzo is going to win it all. Of course, anyone could, but my money is on Lizzo. And that will be one of the rare times where the Grammys go to one of my favorite albums of the year.
Which would be a big deal.
That's right. Oh my God. Is it that time?
It is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. You know that all those people who write in and say, hey, can you like put some like intro music to each segment or like really create a hard, segment your episodes.
I didn't know they wanted this.
We're killing them this week because our transitions are pretty good. Ah. But in any case, our first story, look, last week we told you this was going to happen. We said, Hollywood, the robots are coming for your jobs, okay? Well, this week we have some news for people working in the radio industry, okay? Robots.
Oh my God.
They're coming for your jobs. Heck, automation and corporate playlists have been removing the human element from radio for decades.
Sadly.
Some formats like The Eagle, which is a radio station, and it's a radio station in several markets, by the way.
Oh, a lot. Yeah, it's all over the country. And you know what? We should launch our own radio station, but let's call it Fox.
Ooh, because we own the name.
We own the name. Like that's right.
Yeah, or The Fox, right. Since it's The Eagle. Yeah. Well, The Eagle seems to thrive on generic playlists and, you know, a lack of DJs. But one of the bright spots in radio has been the rise of apps like iHeart. I believe it's called iHeart Radio, in fact. But now, that company has fired 50 DJs and other employees while citing a major investment in artificial intelligence. Actually, they weren't fired. According to iHeart, the DJs were, quote-unquote, dislocated. By the way, that sounds like a word chosen by a robot or a bad PR firm.
Dislocated. Oh my, dislocated. Honey, I've been dislocated.
Yeah, that's actually something you do to your shoulder, not to your job. The company does point out it has 12,500 employees, but on-air talent just shrank. iHeart has 250 million monthly listeners, 850 live broadcast stations, and hundreds of digital platforms. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, they are downplaying DJs. They used to be the heart of radio. They are that no longer. They have less influence over what gets played, and they're not even heard that much anymore. Maybe some local DJ gets to say, hey, and now the weather, but that's about it. So it's a sad day, but it's been a long time coming. Even iHeart, which is sort of flourishing, is scaling back on DJs. Not a good sign. And you know, iHeart is being played more through smart speakers. You see that all the time. And Bose, one of the big smart speakers builders, they are closing down all their stores in the US, Japan, Europe, and Australia, 119 in all. They'll still have stores in the Middle East and Russia and some other places, but Bose is ending.
Why are they doing that?
Because everything is being bought online. You know, they're not making their sales in stores. In fact, one of the malls I go to here in Birmingham used to have a Bose store. It's gone.
You know, I was walking through the mall recently. I had to go to the Microsoft store. I know that sounds
they like have a really store? Weird.
They have a store. It's across from the Apple store at the Westfield Topanga Mall, by the way. And I walked past a shop that I used to go into called The Art of Shaving. It was no longer The Art of Shaving. It was The Art of Shaving like 2 months ago. And they had already closed and opened some other store there. I thought, well, yeah, I guess people don't buy, like, I always thought it was weird. I was like, a whole store for shaving stuff? Okay. But apparently, I wasn't the only one going, really? Because even they went, yeah, this isn't working.
And they're available at Walmart.
What, the Art of Shaving?
Yeah.
Or Bose?
Art of Shaving.
Oh, I had no idea that that's the
case.
At
least Walmart.com.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess they're also
goodbye
available
goodbye traditional retail.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I always liked it when, you know, you have the DJ, like the DJs with personality, you know, the DJs, you know,
yeah.
The Racks on Stacks. It's the best on wax with the boss man, Bob Martin. You know,
that, and they would actually pick songs and push for artists and let you know their personal taste. Those days are gone.
Yes. But, you know, what isn't gone is tourism. In fact, New York enjoyed its 9th straight year of growth in tourism. Woo-hoo! Is Broadway benefiting from that or a big reason? According to the statistics, the international audience attending a Broadway show hit a record high of 2.8 million people, keeping pace with Broadway's record ticket sales of 14.8 million tickets. And people are buying their tickets earlier than ever. They're snagging those seats 47 days ahead of the day they attend. Obviously, if you really want to see a show, waiting to get in line isn't going to cut it. Young people also kept pace with Broadway's growth. They attended in bigger numbers than ever.
So young people are going to Broadway shows. They're going to the movies. Don't worry, Sperling. They're going to be there for you.
They're just, when they're doing those things, not looking up from their phones. So that's, but the average age of theatergoers remained steady at 42 years old. Oh my God, I'm over the hill. Despite 3 million theatergoers being 25 or younger for the third year in a row. And those people, by the way, are paying an average of $145 to get those tickets. And some of them are getting a lot of tickets. This is the number that just, like, my head exploded. 700,000, about 700,000 theater goers on Broadway see more than 5 shows a year. That's almost 5% of theater goers, but they buy more than 25% of all tickets.
1/4 of all ticket sales go to just 5% of the people. That's like movies where a lot of, you know, some people go to the movies all the time. But yeah, that's very telling. And is it a big deal or a big whoop? It's a big deal. It's a big deal that young people are going. It's a big deal that international audiences are remaining a steady part of theater going. It's a big deal that they're heading to New York. Probably in a lot of cases, that's part of the thing. You go to New York, you want to see a Broadway show, and they're planning that in advance because they know they can't wait. You want to see Hamilton, you want to see, you know, Hadestown. You can't just show up and hope to get lucky. If you want a good ticket, you're going to have to pay, and you're going to have to pay in advance. So it's all good news, I think, in terms of all that stuff. It's just too bad ticket prices are so damn expensive.
Well, you know, that reminds me of a statistic I heard recently. That when Amy Miles was still the head of Regal Entertainment Group, the movie theater chain, mm-hmm. that she had this saying, don't F with the 2%. And I think it was 2%. And the F, by the way, fill in the word.
Don't screw with the 2%.
Yeah. And she, 2% or thereabouts of the of her customers were like creating 15% of revenue.
So same idea, just a tiny, tiny percentage of your moviegoers are there all the time, and you want to make sure they're happy because they're the ones who spread the word to everyone else. Two things. First, another stat, 68%, almost 70% of all theatergoers are women. Women dominate Broadway, and they decide what plays get, you know, picked and go to. Women. Those are the people that you care about. And the average age of theater goers has remained about between 40 and 45 for 20 years now. They've only been tracking all these figures since 1984. So we can't go back to the 20s and 30s when Broadway really dominated. But if the age is staying the same, the average age of theater goers is 42. That means it's getting younger because you know what? People keep getting older and people live longer. So if you're staying in the mid-40s for decades, that means your audience is getting lower and lower as the age of the country gets older and older. So many more people are living longer that that's actually a sign of the theater audience getting a little bit younger. And that's why you're also seeing young people make a big chunk of the audience as well. So staying the same age is, you know, if you're not moving up, you're getting younger. So that's great.
Now, this isn't official, but analysts expect Netflix to spend $17 billion on content in 2020. That includes original content and licensing. And yes, $17 billion buys a lot of British royalty, but not that much, okay? I guess that's a reference to The Crown.
That's right.
Now, Netflix is making original content geared towards a dozen plus countries and languages, all of them hopefully ready to reach a worldwide audience. Yeah, I'd like to see content from the other territories.
It's all of them. Well, that's all there. What are you talking about?
I don't know.
What are you complaining about? There's that German thriller, the tunnel or the cave or the dark or whatever it's called. You know, the super. There's tons of content. There's the Yangtze Palace sequel, which is on Netflix right now. There's tons of international content on Netflix. What do you mean? All you have to do is get off your butt and watch it. It's all there. They don't sequester it by country. You can watch everything. Well, don't act like it's not available. Good heavens.
Well, it's certainly reaching critics.
Yeah.
The Crown just won the SAG Award for Best Drama, and Netflix is the most nominated studio when it comes to the Oscars. But $17 billion, that's $1 billion with a B. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? By the way, big deal or big whoop, also with a B.
It is a big deal. It's a lot of money. They are not letting their foot off the pedal yet. For years, before streamers came into play, Netflix said, our content's going to get too expensive. They're either going to charge us through the nose for Friends or they're going to take it away. And they started investing in original content that was smart. It was the right thing to do, but it didn't mean they'd make good stuff. But they are delivering good stuff and popular stuff. So that is all good. They want tons of content. They are growing overseas, so they need more international content. I think at some point they're going to slow down, but with Disney Plus launching and now HBO Max and Peacock, this isn't the time, and they're not slowing down. I think it's a smart investment in the future. I don't have the figures on how much debt they have versus income and royalties and blah, blah, blah. I'm sure that the, you know, that needs to be looked at and be wise. But right now, I think it's very smart. They are paying like tons more than anybody else on original content. And they want to overwhelm the world with lots of original content. And that library will be very valuable for decades to come. So they are going to slow down soon, and that won't be a bad sign. But spending a lot right now, it seems wise to me.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why Rupert Murdoch was like, you know what? It might be time to sell Fox. Because
he didn't want to play that game.
He did not want to play that game. And he knew his age. And he thought, you know what? In 5 years, when I'm even older and may not be around anymore, this company may not be worth as much at that point. So let's sell now. Now, speaking of not being around anymore, there is life after death. For the acclaimed rapper Notorious B.I.G., he's entering the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Biggie Smalls is just one of six acts to make the cut. Also in the hall, Depeche Mode, Nine Inch Nails, T-Rex, and the Doobie Brothers. And the lone woman to receive the honor, Whitney Houston. That leaves nominees Pat Benatar, Todd Rundgren, and the rest hoping next year proves to be the charm. And don't feel bad, Rock Hall. The Songwriters Hall of Fame has more than 431 members, and only 31 of those, or just 7%, only 31 are women. That number bumped up a bit when their new inductees were announced. They included Mariah Carey and the Eurythmics, along with dudes like the Isley Brothers, Neptune, and Steve Miller. A whole planet got in. That's amazing. Yeah, big deal or big whoop.
Whoa. How well read was that, people? Good job, Sperling. I could see the practice and the flow. It was very nicely done. It is a, you know, it's big whoop, of course. It's just the Rock Hall, which someday will change its name to the Popular Music Hall of Fame because you've got rappers and R&B singers and all that. It's a, you know, a fine mix of groups. We've already weighed in on who does and doesn't belong in the hall, but it's cool to see. It's interesting. And if it sends some people back to the music, all for the better.
Well, you know, if the Doobie Brothers didn't get in, people would be taking it to the streets. You know, so by the way, Google that.
Oh, my God.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you remember who Sal Nunziata said should and should not get in?
I do.
And were any of these on his absolutely not list?
I think he didn't think Whitney Houston did. He didn't wildly object, but He felt Pat Benatar did not belong, but Whitney Houston, he thought, a great voice, but he has a problem with someone not being a songwriter or not. I wildly disagree with him on that, but I think he didn't care about Depeche Mode. He was thrilled about the T-Rex. He thought the Doobie Brothers had their arguments. Biggie Smalls, he felt it's such a small career. He wasn't sure.
That's my problem with it. It's like you had two albums. Okay.
But he was wildly influential. You know, Nick Drake deserves to be in the hall, and he had three albums.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Well, what, does Justin Bieber belong?
He will be in there someday.
Well, he has a new song out, plus a new album later this year and a YouTube documentary series about his life. And he keeps wearing a hat that says Cherry on it, which seems, you know, either weirdly suggestive or almost certainly out of date. I don't know. Anyway, in a now deleted social media post, by the way, That is going to be the phrase
of the century.
Of the century. A now deleted social media post. Yeah. His fans were urged to cheat and put his new single on replay, to which I say, you haven't done that already? But the idea is put the song in a playlist, hit repeat, don't turn down the volume, okay? Don't turn it all the way down, because then the plays won't count. And leave that playlist on all night. It was cheeky and playful, and he's not really asking anyone to do it anymore.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, but he kind of is. But it does point to the issue of, you know, heaven help me, God help me, fake music, or as I like to call it, fake music. It goes along with the fake
news.
You sound like
Adam Baldwin, Alec Baldwin, not Trump. But anyway, keep going.
Do I have to say? I guess I did have to say. How about cheating in the music industry? How about we call it that? Big deal or big whoop?
This is a story we haven't really tackled in depth. I'd love to get a guest on. Where we've been slow to get guests in the new year because you've been traveling and stuff. But boy, there's a lot of gaming of the system. YouTube is now being used to influence the album charts of Billboard, right? Billboard said YouTube is part of our ranking system now. We're going to look at plays of albums on YouTube. Well, yet, as many people point out, YouTube can be swamped by cheating and bots and other ways of gaming. Spotify plays are pumped up to increase revenues. YouTube, people do the same to sell ads and now push an album up the Billboard charts. New acts are given prominence the way payola used to get them on the radio. The gaming of the system from streamers and YouTube and all these other ways, it's getting bigger and bigger. It's a big issue, and we're ignoring it right now because it's too complicated, too ugly, and all the big players are involved. They all do it. They all have to do it, they think. And the way to stop it is not clear. But it's a big problem because now we have the Billboard charts are going to be influenced by cheating. Justin Bieber's joking about it. It's happening all the time. There was just a story saying music users on Spotify found their websites hacked, their accounts hacked, and playing this music of this young rapper that they didn't know about. And that rapper said, oh, somebody else is trying to diss me and make me look bad. I mean, it's just this crazy, mixed up, messed up situation. And it's going to be a bigger and bigger problem in the years to come. Music Business Worldwide, great website. They have a great newsletter. They're covering it pretty well on and on. And that some of that stuff is getting into Rolling Stone and elsewhere. But this is a big, ugly story that we've got to tackle at some point.
Well, you know, look, I think you're right. I think it's a lot easier to cheat digitally. And it is the reason why we have to do it. We have placed a camera in the center field bleachers so that we can steal opposing podcasters'
signals. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my, speaking of baseball, it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. They affect you because the Grammy Awards are going to be exciting. Will anybody mention Deborah Dugan? She was the head of the Recording Academy, and like 10 days before the Grammys, they kicked her out. She's a new hire, replacing Neil Portnow, who had problems with women. I should say problems with his public statements about women and their role in the music industry, but also had been there a long, long time. It was time for him to go. They replaced him with a woman, a person who'd worked with U2 and done great work over the years. Now there she is at the Grammys, at the Recording Academy, shaking things up. And they said, oh, we don't want that.
Well, and I'm just going to change one little thing that you said. She didn't work with U2. She worked with Bono on Red.
Red One,
his,
yes.
His nonprofit foundation. And that's where they found her. And she, you know, had worked with all the labels. But she apparently didn't work with the labels when she first got to the Recording Academy. She reached out to...
Well, now you're repeating the Recording Academy's arguments. That's what they've leaked to the press. We all want to know what the hell's going on. How bad could it be that you dumped her just 10 days before the Grammys? You couldn't wait till after the Grammys? So gossip and rumor is coming from both sides.
You didn't let me finish. What I was going to say is the reason she did that, possibly, is because those are her constituents.
Right. The labels think they're in charge. They don't realize the people that matter are the artists. And so,
who are actually members of the Academy.
Right.
FYI.
So the Recording Academy and the people there to press scuttlebutt about her as well, you know, she wasn't really doing her job and reaching out to, she ruffled feathers by reaching out to the artists. The artists, by the way, like Jay-Z, Beyonce, Drake, Ed Sheeran, and Kendrick Lamar, the biggest acts around right now, and the people who have been insulted and annoyed and kept out by the Recording Academy for a decade now, and people who feel offended by them and disinclined and who feel you know, not appreciated or respected. And she said, I'm going to start by reaching out to the people the Recording Academy has insulted and the ones who matter, who are the biggest stars in the world. Don't we want them on board? Don't we want them to feel part of the team? That's what she did. And that's one of their complaints about her. You've got to be kidding me that she didn't go to Warner Brothers first. She went to one of the stars. Give me a break. You are not their owners or their gatekeepers.
I don't know whether, I'll be honest, and I was going to look this up, whether the unlike the Academy Awards, where, yes, the studios pay.
Oh, they're in charge.
But I don't know whether the labels are actually members of the Academy of Recording Arts and Science. I don't know.
If you are the head of Warner Brothers Music or Universal or Sony, and you think you are more important than Jay-Z or Beyonce or Drake or Ed Sheeran, call them up and tell them that. You tell them, I'm more important than you. You are not the star. I'm the person that matters. I'm the person the Grammy should be kowtowing to. And before they bother any of my acts, like you're a plantation owner, by the way, you better come to me first because I'm Big Daddy. Really? That's their attitude? And this is their attempt to make her look bad. This is what they literally said. Well, you know what she did. She really ruffled feathers because she went to the recording stars rather than the labels.
This to me sounds like the shakeup of any like dictatorship, right? Like whenever a dictator gets, you know, thrown out of office
or dies.
Where like all of a sudden, and by the way, this happens in China every 10 years when, you know, they elect a new president.
Not anymore.
That's another story. Yeah. But like all of the people who had an allegiance with that particular
Make life miserable for the next person.
Make life miserable or they get thrown out. Right. And I'm specifically referring to these two outside law firms that were paid about $15 million last year, year in, year out. And obviously were a part of a regime that was, I don't want to say loyal to Neil Portnow, but working with Neil Portnow.
Yeah.
And she kind of came in, she did an audit of the books, and this is Deborah Dugan.
She wasn't even done yet doing auditing, I imagine.
Right, she kind of like looked around and said, okay, well, let's
we don't let's have an in-house lawyer, is what she said. Why are we paying two outside firms all this money? Why don't we have our own in-house lawyer?
Which you can pay far less than $15 million a year.
Right.
And so she kind of started looking at some of the long-held
practices and activity
that the Academy did and kind of said, wait, we need to change a few things here. She was moving very, very quickly. She's only been in for about 6 to 8 months, and she obviously ruffled a few feathers. The only thing that I have heard negative about her where I'm like, well, is that true? And that is actually, and I will follow this up, Michael, so let me get this all the way out. Which is that she had a bullying management style, which, by the way, was a complaint that was leveled at her by Neil Portnow's old assistant.
And her current assistant, you know.
And her current assistant.
Right-hand person. Yeah.
To which I would say, yeah, okay, people, you know, is it true? Let's hear from others who were in the office. And if true, well, hey, you know, there are, you know, programs for that, management programs that can teach you, hey, you can't really be a bully in the office.
Yeah, I don't. I hate to downplay that idea because I think that's all BS. Like, or in the entertainment business, or you're a director, or you're a producer, like Joel Silver, you get to throw shit at me.
No.
Exactly. So I agree with you. Like, we don't want to completely dismiss that offhand, and like that behavior is unacceptable. That should not be happening. Not in a corporate office. Not on a sound stage. Not in a recording studio. That's ridiculous. However, this is a woman. Like, you have all these men behaving like bullies, and now the woman, like, oh, she's the one behaving like a bully. Suddenly, you can't help feeling that her behavior, people wouldn't even think to question if she was a man, much less it's Neil Portnow's loyal assistant, who is hers. Clearly, she needed to shake people up and get people fired and get new people in who could be loyal to her, or at least loyal to the Recording Academy rather than whomever the latest head is. But, you know, you want more details on that, but given that I've not heard of her throwing stuff at her or anything that sounds horrifying or egregious, sounds maybe obnoxious. I don't know. Maybe she's got big elbows. I've been accused of a bullying behavior too myself. And, you know, even though I was never a boss, at least in the magazine world, like, oh, Michael, you speak your mind too much. I'm like, what? But so those things are possible. But boy, that's the worst thing that they have about her. I don't feel like we've heard from Deborah Dugan yet. Everything has come from the other side, I feel like. Slowly, a little bit's coming out from her side.
Well, she's being very smart.
But even the stuff, she has people saying things like she wanted to get those law firms pushed out and saying she was shaking things up. But the stuff that you tried to say to make her look dumb or bad, to me, just makes her look good.
Well, and what I would say is, obviously, the concept of pushing somebody out
that soon,
10 days before the awards, really not a good move. Yeah,
you couldn't even wait 2 weeks. Give me a break, you know.
So if you think, so if your mentality and your wisdom is so, you know, awe-inspiring that's your move, then obviously you might want to double check the things that you think everybody's going to be like, yeah, she was wrong for the job. Yeah,
right from the start, it was terrible. You know, that's what the board is saying. She didn't get along with the board. The board didn't get along with her. She was moving too fast. She had, you know, sharp elbows. But now she was abusive to her assistant. Well, we had to act. I can't believe you couldn't wait 10 days. That alone makes you look like idiots.
Right. And that's what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like, exactly. You know, your judgment is called into question.
So her time at the Grammys, at the Recording Academy, is over. It seems like a shame. I hope they find somebody who will also be ready to clean house, because they need that shakeup. But the time is over for Nancy Lewis Jones. We talked about her a little bit last week.
Can I just add to the Dennis
Dugan? Oh, sure.
I almost said Dennis Dugan, by the way.
You're racist. Sexist.
No, Dennis Dugan is a director that I used to work with.
Oh, funny.
Big Daddy.
You're just old.
Yeah, pretty much. That's really what it is. So one of the things she was pointing out is, you know, the way we choose these nominees and the people that are selected to be honored, yeah, it's not really correct, and it's only a handful of people are doing it. And
I don't
know
about correct. I haven't heard this issue.
Yeah, that was one of the things that she highlighted. So that's, you know,
and something
we'll just
that's
leave
ripe
that.
For overview for sure. Well,
correct.
And now for something completely different. Publicist Nancy Lewis Jones is still dead.
Yes, we talked about her last week, but we didn't talk about these two additional stories that we heard about. Yeah. Apparently, people loved her.
Yeah, well, we knew that. She was one of those unsung talents who champion artists and helped their careers along. People like The Who, Genesis, and Monty Python's Flying Circus. God bless her for that. We talked about her career last week. Then the New York Times did an obit, so she's not quite that unsung anymore. I love these two stories. Tell the first one. It's about Brazil.
Well, Terry Gilliam, you know, he made this movie, Brazil.
Fox, and of course Fox. It was against Fox.
Yes, that's true. Your name now.
We make a quarter every time you say Fox.
Well, you know, Fox was like, yeah, we don't like this cut. We're going to try and edit it.
They wouldn't do anything. They did their own. They wouldn't release it. They wouldn't release his edit or their edit. They just sat on it.
So she took a print of the film over to the Los Angeles film critics and showed it to them. And they then named the unreleased movie Brazil the best film of the year, which kind of forced Fox hand.
Like,
you know, they kind of had to say
fine.
Here
and if you can see that edit on like the Criterion box set, and his choices were better.
Yes,
he also met her husband, actor Simon Jones, on the set of the Monty Python film Life of Brian. In 1985, he was in Michael Frayn's Benefactors on Broadway, playing a character who at one point has a bowl of stew thrown at him. To help him figure out how to play that scene, she would surprise him in the shower by throwing a bowl of water on him, then assess his reaction. He said she was a great enabler. Can you imagine? Your wife suddenly attacks you with a bowl of water. You're like, ah! So she sounds like a fun, great person. And those two little stories were pretty great. So sad to see Nancy Lewis Jones is gone, but glad to know she has loved and appreciated.
Well, and we hope you loved and appreciated this week's episode. You know, if you subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. But if you subscribe to our show, you will not miss an episode. And you know what? All of the information on ways to subscribe to our show can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those news stories we just talked about. Links to all of them are on showbizsandbox.com, as well as ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's our email address. We also have a voicemail that you can call and leave a message on. That's 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. And on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox is our page. Again, all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's freedeborahdugan.org.
Oh, ooh, a nonprofit. I like it. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.
I love being aggregated.